22B1. We'll start on the right side of the page. I'll just take a moment to review what the subject was. If you remember, we were discussing the subject of Yesh Avelut Shabbat or Ein Avelut Shabbat. Is there Avelut mourning on the Sabbath, or is there not Avelut on the Sabbath? Now, that did not mean necessarily the cancellation of all types of Avelut, although conceivably it could. And we did come to two points of view, one of which says, Yesh Avelut HaShabbat. To say Yesh Avelut HaShabbat, there is Avelut on Shabbat, that doesn't mean all of the things happen on Shabbat, all of the customs pertain on Shabbat, only those that are private. But if we say Ein Avelut HaShabbat, there is no mourning on Shabbat, what we mean is that there is no mourning, even the private customs of mourning. We looked then at the Tosafot in order to see what we were talking about. And the principal manifestation of the law, the principal issue that really was being talked about but wasn't being said in so many words, was the law that when one is mourning, a very private thing is prohibited, namely sexual relations. So that really is the force of the issue here. It's not the only private thing, because it could be also said of the laws of mourning, sexual relations. We'll see, this is going to come up a little bit further on. Washing, there are certain washing prohibitions. Wearing of shoes, it could be contended that that was something that was something that would happen, you know, only in the home, in the precincts of the home, possibly. But we saw that the Tosafot referred to this as Dvarim Shebetzina'ah. Those things which are, Betzina is in private. Those things which are in private. And we were really referring then to sexual relations, Tashmish HaMitza. Now, on the right side of the page, 23B1, the halfway down on that side, the Gemara says what it will occasionally say when it's dealing with an issue that's being discussed among the Amoraim. It will sometimes wax into a discussion about whether there is Tanaitic precedence for this very same type of argument. So the Gemara says, Lema Katanae. Let us say that this disagreement about Yesh or Ein Avelut Shabbat, and what that means, again, is if there is Avelut on Shabbat, the private things are observed on Shabbat, even though nobody will observe public things. That we know. I'm not worried about that. Shall we say that this is also reflected in a Tanaitic dispute? Right? Now remember, if we can find something that is a dispute, or we can clarify an issue as it appears among the Tanaim, sometimes that can give us a lot of insight into what's going on. Tanaim are earlier, they have more authority than the later Amoraim, and so I just have to see whether this dispute that is among the Tanaim applies to our situation. So we begin that. This is the Baraita, and the Baraita goes like this. We did about half the Baraita last night. Mi shemeto mutar lefanav, a person who has his dead one stretched out in front of him. Now this is the Talmud's way of referring to somebody who is an onein. Remember, an onein is the situation that you find yourself in when there has been a death, but there has not yet been a burial. So it's the period of time between the death and the burial itself. And the mourner who would otherwise be a mourner after the burial probably doesn't yet observe, it's not totally clear, apparently doesn't observe the laws of mourning. But there are certain things that happen to that person, certain freedoms, in fact, from the obligations of the law, which begin to pertain for the person who is an onein. Any of you who have been in this situation, have been close to people who are in this situation, know that it's a very disorienting situation to be in. When you, there are really two sides to it. If you are the particular person who has the responsibility of seeing through the funeral arrangements and the burial, that's one area that's disorienting in and of itself. You have to think about things to be, to feel the kinds of odd pressures that you feel. It's really hard. It's a hard time. Forget that. Let's say you're not in that position. You're not the one who's responsible for the burial. Still, you're potentially a mourner. You're close to the person. And you really can't begin to process things, interestingly enough, until after the burial. There's something really serene about the burial that just creates a new reality. And until the burial takes place, until you've dealt with the remains, that reality really hasn't happened yet. You're in the middle of one reality that's a new one, which is that suddenly the person that is your close relative, your loved one, is dead. And that in itself would be disorienting. It's incredibly disorienting. That you can't move to process it, which really only can begin once the burial has taken place, sort of multiplies the difficulty of the situation. Okay? So that's the situation of the one. So that's what we're talking about when we say Nisha Metomu Talafanav. Probably this is reflecting the reality of Talmudic times. When a death occurred, there's no morgue, no hospital, there's no funeral chapel. What do you do with the body? Basically, the body's laid out at home. All right, the body's at home. Ochel b'vayet acher. And if you remember, I said that here, probably bayet could either mean bayet, that if you are in the situation of being an onein, and the dead person is right in the house with you, in the room with you, you eat in a different house, or it could be that bayit means a different cheder, a different room in the house. Because, I mean, our whole concept of a house is an artificial concept. I live in a house. There are a lot of other people who live in the same house. It's called an apartment. What's the difference between my apartment and the next guy's apartment? A wall. But even I have walls myself, and it's still my apartment. You know, it's really a key door, an entry door. So the notion of bayit here is almost a metaphoric notion. Okay? Whatever it is, what you should do is ochel bevayit acher. You should eat in another house or in another room. Ein lo bayit acher. If you don't have another house, you don't have another room, ochel bevayit chavero. You should go next door to your friend. Right, and eat there. Ein lo bet chavero. If you don't have a house of a friend where you can eat, oselo mechitza, mechitza asarat afachim. You make a partition between you and the deceased. Right, you're all in one room, so to eat and to just carry on in front of the body that can no longer have these enjoyments, the enjoyments, as we would say, of the flesh. Enjoyments of the flesh really depend upon the soul. Once the soul is departed from the body can't enjoy the flesh anymore. Okay? There is no self there. There is no eating. And interestingly enough, we take very seriously those enjoyments of the flesh. And this is then a situation potentially of loeg larash. Loeg larash is where you mock the poor. The deceased is the poor. Okay? The deceased is the poor. That's the same reason, by the way, why we close the casket at a funeral. Because of loeg larash. Loeg larash.
Because of why?
Loeg larash. Mocking the poor. That is to say, somebody will come in and say, oh, he looks so nice. Or, oh, he doesn't really look so nice. He looked nicer the last time I saw him. All that kind of conversation is inappropriate, okay? Because one of the things that you can no longer do once you're dead is decide how you're going to present yourself to other people.
hopefully fun.
Okay, great. And the very, the most elemental thing that we do that is really a real sign of who we are is that we have a sense of self-consciousness. And we think about, among other things, how we want to be presented to other people. The dead can't do that. Therefore, is lo'eg l'rash. One would, if one, there are situations where one is mocking the poor. It's not, you know, a poor person has limited options. The dead is the extreme case of that.
Lo'eg,
what is it? Lo'eg is to mock. Lamed, not ayin. Lamed ayin gimel. Lamed ayin gimel. Well, you say low egg is the bird. Okay. 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 Ain't lo b'mardecha. Okay. B'beit chaveru. Ain't lo b'beit chaveru. Oselo mechitza sarat tefachim. Ain't lo davar la'asot mechitza. If you do not have something to make a partition between you and the deceased, machazir panav v'ochel. You turn around. You still have to eat. You're permitted to eat. You don't have to fast. But you turn around and you don't face the deceased.
If the body is taken, my father died on Friday about 2 o'clock till the funeral pall was up there. I took him out and Sunday morning we had a burial. Now, how does the eating apply to a situation like that?
They're not in the same room. If they took them away, this is all assuming that the deceased and the mourner, the potential mourner, are in the same room. If they've taken the body away, then it's not an issue anymore. Okay.
Now, when we were in Israel a couple of times ago, we went to that Talmudic village where they have
Katsurin.
And I keep picturing those homes. Because that's really when we're writing.
Right, that's right. That's what it's.
And
that's
they
what it's
were in a one room. And one upstairs, kind of climbing up to a little sleeping
loft,
quarter. So there is no place else. I mean, you know, that you are in that room, that was the all purpose room.
So you can well understand then, and people live fairly close to one another, that you'll go to buy it of Chavero.
Mm-hmm.
You go to your friend's house.
Very
close. Right,
close.
Can one infer from here that the practice of not ever leaving the corpse alone is something later in history, or is this isn't why you eat, so you go somewhere else, but somebody else comes in the meantime to be
mm-hmm. Well, the issue of leaving the corpse alone is in Masechet Brachot, and the truth is the Baraita may not know about that. It's possible, because I believe it's a Tanaitic idea, but I'm not sure. So it's possible that the Braita is not reflecting that, and that either it wasn't a practice or it wasn't an articulated practice. They just didn't write about it. I don't know. Or it could be what you just said. The other possibility, that the assumption here is that you would leave somebody with the body, even if it wouldn't be you, and you would be eating.
Okay. Last week I asked you if a practice, okay, in terms of what could it be interpreted as doing something so that in respect to the dead, okay, and your reply was that the dead wasn't for the dead, it was for us, okay, the practice. I don't see how that coincides with this concept of mocking the poor that we talked about here. The body is just the body, it's gone, okay,
mm-hmm.
The soul is.
We're not yet mourners. When I answered your question, you asked about the laws of mourning. I was correct. The laws of mourning have not yet taken place. The laws of mourning do not begin till after the burial. Okay? So at this point, the law that is functioning is the law of Kvod HaMet, which is the honor of the deceased. We are not yet focused on the mourner. We are entirely focused on the deceased.
What happens at the moment of death? Does the soul leave the body and we just left with the body? Okay. What's there to respect, whether it's buried or not? That's what my question
is. The thing to respect is the body that's created by God. God creates the body. And therefore, because God creates the body is holy. And, by extension, because the body housed the soul, the body is holy. Okay? So we have this notion of the body that you have to respect the body. Not because necessarily of the person who was the person, but because the creator of the person. Let's say a person was a Russia. They were wicked. You know, what do you do with a wicked person when they die? Are the laws any different? No. Because that soul, that the wicked soul's got to be judged. That soul be judged. What's left is the body created by God. And God was not wicked. God gave a person a body. But he messed his life up. That's the person. But God is the author of the body, the creator of the body. So it's, in a way, it's and it comes from, of course, the book of Genesis, that the body itself was created in the image of God. Okay? So, I mean, it has its problems. You mean to say God looks like the way we look. It's hard to say. But we do have this basic idea of the holiness of the body. Okay? It's an interesting idea, by the way. It's one of the classic issues between Judaism and Christianity. In the history of Christianity is actually much more interesting than Judaism on this score, because Christianity has far more extreme ideas than we do, extreme in all directions. Frequently, we will know that Christianity denies the body. That a good denies the body. A good Christian will deny the body. But you have the opposite in Christianity as well. Christianity has asceticism, but Christianity has this radical notion of what's called the incarnation, that God became human. God became human. And therefore you have the opposite strand in Christianity as well. So you have a very positive view and a very negative view that sort of fight with each other all the time in the history of Christianity. Judaism, we don't have that. We only have one view. And it has nothing to do with the incarnation, that God becomes man. Rather, it has to do with the creation, that the Bible speaks of the creation of the body as the handiwork of God.
And what constitutes an
asarat fachim? Some object that is 10 handbreadths in height. So this is a handbreadth.
Right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. A handbreadth is, let's see, how many inches? About 6 inches, about 7 inches. So that's 70 inches. So you're talking about something that's 5 to 6 feet in height.
You, from here to here?
Is one handbreadth.
Yeah, you've got 7 inches. Though.
Yeah, so from here to here is about seven inches.
He's got a bigger hand than you. Count the sum.
That's not the twice than that? 4 inches? That's all? Okay.
Well, isn't that also the limit, the lower limit for a sukkah?
Correct.
I have a practical question. If somebody dies in the North Country and you can't bury them, so the body is kept until the soil is able to be dug up. Now, what do you do then? Did you show up 3 months later when you've already been torn off the first time?
It's much like the situation that we read about a few weeks ago, where you take the body to Jerusalem. Remember what happened then? When you leave the body, you start Shiva. So that if, for practical purposes, you can't bury, it's the same as the people who are not going with the body. So in effect, you start Shiva immediately as soon as you leave the body. And it would make logical sense, too. The body, as much as, yes, normally you have to have the burial, if you give me a, well, what in this case where you can't do it? Well, in that case where you can't do it, we don't turn everything upside down, because indeed we have to make that transition to the mourners. As difficult as that is, it's a very difficult and unpleasant situation. That's why in New York, for example, it's we have never had a situation where the frozen ground has been a problem in New York.
No.
I've actually had a situation where we couldn't fill in. Get the grave diggers and the Excuse me?
Couldn't get enough dirt to fill in?
No. Describe what happened. These days, what they do, the practical side of it is, these days, you can always dig. They dig with one of these backhoes. So there's a mechanical way of digging a grave, even if a human being doesn't dig a grave. And the backhoe is able to do it even in frozen ground. That's just modernity. That's what you can do. However, what happens is that they take out the dirt, pile it next to the grave. So you get there. Let's say you've had 3 weeks of frozen weather, or a month of frozen weather. This is what happens like that. So, in fact, you get there and there's a grave. I've never seen that not happen, except one exception, which I'll tell you about in a minute. So that happens. The dirt is on the outside. Within 6-8 hours, the dirt freezes. It freezes. So that, in fact, when you come with the shovel, you can't do anything with it. You can't. You jump on the shovel and it goes no place. I've had that situation. And again, you do what you have to do. If you can't do it, you can't do it. If you have to then wait for the backhoe to come and you know it'll do it in its time, that's what you do in a case like that. The only situation which we have from time to time, and it's really a very bad situation, and we try to use government to avoid this, is the grave digger's strike. Strikes are the bigger problem. When you have a strike, then in fact you've got a real problem because you can't cross, or you can't, you just can't do this. Either you can or you may be able to cross the picket line, but people are not expert in digging graves. So that's when you really have problems. And in recent years, once we had that. And again, what you try to do is that you try to use the civil authorities. And they're usually pretty good about that. In the city of New York, for example, civil authorities are very respectful of religious issues. Very respectful. It's true in the hospital system. It's true in the morgue. It's true in terms of negotiations. You never have a problem. It's just there are limits to what they can actually do. But they're really on your side. And sometimes you're able to make arrangements so that there are exceptions. That the grave diggers will, let's say, allow the Chevra Kadishas to go in. And there are Chevra Kadishas that do go into cemeteries, and they just dig. Because you don't need a professional to do it, you just need somebody who's able to do it. Okay?
Are the Jewish grave diggers in their own union, or is this a...
No, it's a universal union, as far as I know. I don't think it's a Jewish... Of course, Jewish grave diggers means grave diggers who dig in Jewish cemeteries. I've never seen a Jewish grave digger. I mean, except for Chevra Kadisha. The grave diggers have, with the immigrant populations over the years, I've seen that the cast of characters changes by nationality. Today they tend to be East Europeans. For a while they were black, then they were Puerto Rican, and now they're East Europeans, the grave diggers. Oh, they still have a scattering of the others, too. Now, in the old days, it used to be a Catholic guy, an Italian Catholic, was the boss, and it was all the black people who were digging the graves. Today it's different. Today the black man is the boss, it's Eastern Europeans who are digging the graves. So that's the beauty of American society.
So in the situation you described, if the ground is too frozen for you to fill in, you just leave. Now that seems to me contrary to everything we just said about respecting.
So what would you like us to do?
Well, I mean, can you just not leave it in the open grave until the soil is ready to be moved?
No, it's better to be in the open grave than to, because it, in effect it's going to be dealt with relatively shortly. It's just we're talking about this hour or next hour.
Oh, so a backhoe is going to come in the same day.
Correct.
Oh yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. The problem you have when you have a strike is that what they do when you have a strike is that they set up tents, and then they line up the coffins inside the tents. And you just basically leave the coffin in a tent. So that's a real problem. Okay?
I, I just was thinking when we talk about frozen ground, we should remember that this was written by people who lived in countries.
Of course, in terms of their reality, definitely is a warm climate. Sure. Sure. Okay.
They didn't have backhoes either.
Yeah. And they didn't need them. Yeah. They didn't need them. Okay, so we're still in the man who wants to have dinner. That's this guy. Wanting to have dinner, so he couldn't make a petition, so he turned around. Excuse me. Even so, however he sets it up, eino meisei v'ochel. He doesn't eat while reclining. Remember, haseba is a fancy type of eating. It's what we do on Pesach, the Seder. Eino ochel basar v'eino shotei yayin. He doesn't eat meat and he doesn't drink wine. Those are particular pleasures of the body. Okay, and one doesn't do that in the face of the deceased. Even where there is a mechitza, still you don't do certain things that are particularly pleasurable. It's just not appropriate. Simply not appropriate. Forget the body for a while. Even just the body is there and you're here, even if you create a mechitza, still certain things you don't do. Now, it's important to keep this in mind. There's a certain logic here, or there's a certain emotional reaction to appropriateness and inappropriateness, because we're going to eventually get to one thing that's our concern. The Ein Mevarech, he doesn't recite a blessing. Now, here we're getting the halachic side of things, that a person, so if you're going to eat bread, you don't say a motzei lechem min ha'aretz. The Ein Mezamein, you don't say Birkat HaMazon. Or if there are several people who are eating together, you don't say the Zimun, Rabotai Nevarech. You don't say that. Normally, Zimun is an obligation. If three people eat together, you are obligated to make a Zimun. Say Rabotai Nevarech, Yishem, and so on. Here, you don't do it. You don't do it. The Ein Mevarchim Alav. Others do not recite the blessing for him. In other words, let's say you're eating with somebody else who is not a mourner. A potential mourner again, and not an onen. And that person says, "All right, I'll eat the bread." I say, "Amosi lechem min haaretz," and you say, "Amen." And okay, you don't even say, "Amen." The Ein Mezamnin alav, he can't be counted in the zimun. Remember, we said that there have to be three people to say Rabotai Nevarech. Three people have to say that. The Ein Mezamnin alav, you can't count him among the three. Upator mi kriyat shema, and he is free from the mitzvah of reading the shema. Now, those of you who have been coming to the minyan in the morning, I've been talking for about the last 2 weeks about kriyat shema, that it is a mitzvah of the Torah to read the shema in the morning and in the evening every single day, 7 days a week. It's a mitzvah of the Torah. Okay, it's an obligation to do that. By the way, it's a worthwhile thing to remember in terms of coming to the synagogue. I've found in Shabbat, when people come to the synagogue on Shabbat, an awful lot of people don't come till after Kriyat Shema. And they come, they'll come to the Torah reading, or they'll come a Musaf, sometime like that, or in the middle between those things. Truth is, no matter when you come, you have to make sure that you say the Shema. Okay? You could even say it at home. You could do it. But there's a mitzvah, there's no mitzvah of the Torah to say Musaf. No mitzvah at all. You could forget Musaf. But there is a mitzvah of the Torah to say the Shema.
Not the Shema and Kedusha. Does that count?
The Shema and Kedusha does not count. Because one of the things we also learned is that when you say the Shema, there are two sides to the concentration of the Shema. One is that you pay attention to what you're saying and what it means. The second is that when you say it to fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. When you're hearing the Kedusha, you should be saying the Kedusha, not the Shema. You shouldn't be concentrating on saying the Shema, you should be concentrating on saying the Kedusha. So you have to say the Shema by itself for that sake, for the sake of that purpose. Okay? So you can't say Shema, Uminat Tefillah. Right? It's a rabbinic mitzvah to say the Tefillah, the Shemoneh Esrei, the silent devotion. Uminat tefillin. Now it says from the tefillin that has to be a mistake, because this is talking about Shabbat. Okay, this is talking about Shabbat, or at least we understand that the context of this is all about Shabbat. There's no mitzvah of tefillin on Shabbat. So either this baraita dates from a time when there was a mitzvah tefillin on Shabbat, or there was a place or a rabbi who believed that there was a mitzvah tefillin on Shabbat, or it's a mistake. So it's a
Steinzel says, V'im hayaze b'Shabbat. His explanation, where it says b'Shabbat, he puts in the phrase V'im hayaze b'Shabbat.
Where is that?
In other words, Umikol mitzvot ha'murot b'Torah uve Shabbat.
This is the continuation.
Oh, that's the continuation. I see.
And what does that mean, v'im
hayaze? In other words, as if the earlier references were to.
Oh, I see. No, that's right. No, you're all right. I'm mistaken here. The first part of this, I mean, the whole thing is if it's on Shabbat. That's not true. We didn't get to that yet. That's right. Umina tefillin, that's in general. On a weekday, an onen is free from the mitzvah of tefillin. Okay? Umikol mitzvot amurot b'Torah. Now here's the general statement. It's actually missing a little piece. The onen is free from all of the positive mitzvot. It's all the mitzvot asay Shabbat Torah. All the positive mitzvot. The onen is not free from negative mitzvot. An onen can't have lobster. Okay, because the Torah says you can't eat those things. Right? So the onen can't do that. But the onen is free from all the positive commandments of the Torah. They call me for the Amor of the Torah.
In the English translation, at least, seems to waffle between is not obligated to or may not. And is that specific to each of the different ones, or is that variations in the interpretation?
No, it's probably the language is accurate, and it's a worthwhile thing to point out. When it says Eino may save the Ochel, he doesn't eat in a reclining manner. That is different than when it says Patur. Patur actually means that a person is free from an obligation. So here, when you're dealing with something like Eino may save, it's in no manner is it an obligation to recline except on at the Seder. So what it is saying is that these are protocols of proper behavior. Let's see whether there's more. Monuments.
So it looks to me like there are three levels, at least in English. You've got the may not eat meat, then there is he does not recite a blessing, and then it says he is not obligated to recite the after meal blessings. He cannot be included in the simeon, and he is exempt. So there, again, I don't know if the English reflects the Hebrew appropriately, but it's like a whole series of subtle gradations here.
That's a legal issue if you're not obligated. Just as if the argument is about whether a woman could be shaluyas tzibur, because she wasn't obligated to, she couldn't fulfill the obligation on behalf of somebody, a man who is.
Mm-hmm.
So part of this.
Part of it is that, correct. With the blessings, for example.
Yeah.
You can't say a blessing for somebody else unless you have an equal level of obligation between you and that somebody else. Okay? In this case, since the onen has no obligation, you can't say the blessing for him. Okay? So there is a subtlety of language there. It comes from the presupposition that he has lost his obligation, and therefore you can't do certain things. Okay? Okay, let's keep going on. Ube Shabbat. Now we go to Shabbat. This is now so far in Onen in general, and now specifically on Shabbat. Look what happens on Shabbat. Meisei v'ochel. On Shabbat, you're allowed to recline and eat. V'ochel basar v'shote yayin. You can eat meat and drink wine on the Sabbath. Umevarech umezamein. And he says blessings, namely, it's correct, the way it translates it is he must recite the blessing before eating, and the after meal blessings. Umevarchin umezamein alav. And others may recite the blessing for him, and maybe he may be included in the zimun. So he has all of the obligations which he was free from as a normal onein during the week. And now suddenly comes the Sabbath, and the Sabbath, it's as if, you know what? Ein avelut b'Shabbat. That's where we're going with this. All right? Suddenly we see a vast difference where a person is free from mitzvah during the week normally, right? Because he's in avel. And now suddenly, well, that's the thing. We're not sure whether they're going to be the same. Suddenly, now on the Sabbath, he's got his usual obligations. So there's a vast difference between the weekday and the Sabbath.
Not just obligations, though, he has the privilege of eating meat.
He also has the privilege, correct. Now, well, I'll get to Rashi in a minute, which this is relevant to. V'chayav b'kriyat shema u'bitfila. He's obligated to say the Shema and to read the Amida. Ubit Tfilin. Here's where it's a mistake. You can't be obligated with Tfilin. Uvechol mitzvot ha'amuro patarah. All of the things that he was free from during the weekdays, he's obligated to do on the Sabbath. Rabban Gamliel omer mitoch shenit chayev be'elu nit chayev b'chulam. Rabban Gamliel says, since he is obligated with all of these things, he's obligated with everything, with everything. So first we saw the Beraita, called the Tana Kama, the first Tana, who states all of these many things. During the weekday, you're free from the mitzvot. On the Sabbath, you're obligated with the mitzvot. Okay? And then Rabban Gamliel seems to be implying something more. Not clear exactly what. He says, since he is obligated with these things that you just mentioned above, he's obligated with everything. Well, frankly, when I read the Baraita above about all the things he's obligated to do on the Sabbath, I thought it was talking about everything.
Does it say that explicitly?
Well, it's...
Before you get to Rabban Gamliel, it says, Ubechol mitzvot ha'amuro patarah.
Maybe. Maybe that includes everything, or maybe it doesn't include everything, because maybe there are things that are not mitzvot of the Torah that may be relevant in the discussion. Maybe. Okay. Allow me that possibility. I'll prove it shortly. Okay? Va'amar Rabbi Yochanan, said Rabbi Yochanan, Tashmish Amita Ikebenayu. Oh, what is the difference? What is Rabbi Gamliel talking about? What is he referring to? He is referring to sexual relations. He is referring, when he says that everything is permitted on the Sabbath, he means even sexual relations are permitted on the Sabbath. Now, wouldn't that have been implied above? As Dan was saying, it says, what does it say? The language is, this general language. Okay. You know what? Sexual relations and the prohibition of sexual relations doesn't appear in the Torah to begin with. So it's not in the Torah. So it could very well be, to begin with, that this is, that Rabban Gamliel, in his own euphemistic way, they know what they're talking about. Sexual relations is things you talk about from the side and not directly.
Okay.
What? Yeah, but you don't have to have sexual relations. I mean, you don't have to have them all the time. You have to have them while you're mourning. Because the laws of mourning say you're not allowed to have them. Okay, the laws of mourning specifically say you're not allowed to have them. Now, the laws of mourning are not from the Torah. The laws of mourning are from the rabbis. Okay? So the rabbis can tell you not to do certain things which the Torah allows you to do. And the real force of the issue here is, what about on the Sabbath? What about on the Sabbath? Because we could say there is a situation which I mentioned to you last week where there might conceivably be an obligation to have sexual relations. Namely, that a husband and a wife have not had relations. There are a certain minimal amount of those relations required in a period of a month. And let's say that didn't happen. So you might say there is an obligation there. There is a positive obligation. Right? That's one possibility. But then the laws of mourning say that you're not allowed to do it. And that also makes sense. You're not allowed to do it. You're not allowed to have those relations. Because the laws of mourning pertain for 7 days. The real force of this question has got to be then, is there mourning on the Sabbath? Is there mourning? That's why it's an issue. That's why it's a problem here. Because indeed, these are things that you might think should happen on the Sabbath. But then again, maybe they shouldn't happen on the Sabbath. And let's just look at the Rashi. Let's just look at the Rashi here. I'm looking at the Rashi Ketav Yad, the manuscript. The Rashi manuscript. Okay, Rashi manuscript is the Ochel. Just look down about one quarter or one third of the way from the bottom. A very tiny print on the inner margin. Let's start with the Ochel Basar V'Chaya B'Chol Mitzvot. Okay? That's on the Sabbath then. The person's required to eat meat and drink wine and they'll observe all the mitzvot. Tfilin Lo Garsinan. It shouldn't read tfilin. Okay? To Ein Tfilin B'Shabbat. Because you're not supposed to put on tefillin on Shabbat. The Katuv, because it is written, Ki Oti, because it is written that the Sabbath is a sign. Oti liolam, b'niu v'en b'nei Yisrael. It is a sign between me and the people of Israel. Mi tzarich non ot, do we need a sign? Yas'u tefillin, she'en tzrichim ot, she'en atzman ot. Because it says, you shall make them for a sign upon your arm. So if the Sabbath is already a sign, then you don't wear the tefillin which are there to be a sign. Okay? Ot and ot. Right? So the tefillin shouldn't be here. Then it goes on. L'Rabban Gamliel Nichayev the Mitzvat Oneg the Shabbat. This is a key thing. Rabban Gamliel, according to Rashi now, obligates a person with the mitzvah of oneg on Shabbat. Oneg on Shabbat. We have a mitzvah, which is a mitzvah, I'm not sure whether it's a mitzvah of the Torah, it's probably not a mitzvah of the Torah, it's a mitzvah from the prophets, which it's from the prophet Isaiah. So it probably is most correctly understood as a mitzvah of the rabbis. Isaiah is considered rabbinic, as it were. But there's a mitzvah of oneg, of pleasure on Shabbat. Oh, now we say there's a mitzvah of pleasure on Shabbat. If there's a mitzvah of pleasure on Shabbat, Rabban Gamliel holds that there is a mitzvah of pleasure on Shabbat. If there's a mitzvah of pleasure on Shabbat, then you could have sex. Then you could have sex. Okay. Isaiah probably has more clout than the rabbis of the Talmud. Right? If Isaiah says that it's the karaten Shabbat oneg, you shall call the Sabbath joy. Oneg is pleasure. Pleasure, joy. Okay? Oneg Shabbat. The ein, and here's how Rashi finishes up. Nechaye the mitzvat oneg the Shabbat. Rabban Gamliel requires a person to have pleasure on Shabbat. Why? De'ein avelut the Shabbat. There is no mourning on Shabbat according to Rabban Gamliel. Oh, here's where we were going all along. We said, can we say lema? Can we say now that this dispute among Tanaim, namely, the Baraita that we just read, which has a Tana Kama, a first Tana who comes and teaches the whole Baraita, except for the last line, which is Rabban Gamliel. And there's obviously a difference between the two. And Rabban Gamliel believes that you can have sex on Shabbat. If Rabban Gamliel believes that you can have sex on Shabbat, then obviously there is no mourning on Shabbat. Mourning meaning private things on Shabbat. Also, this is just like what we were saying. We had an Amoraic argument before. Aviesh Avelut B'Shabbat or Ein Avelut B'Shabbat. There is a religion. Now we see an argument among the Tanaim. The unnamed Tana says, there is mourning on Shabbat, and then you can't have sex. Rabban Gamliel says and comes and says, at least it's understood by Rabbi Yochanan here, Rabbi Gamliel comes and says, you can have sex on Shabbat, namely, Ein Avelut B'Shabbat. There is no mourning on Shabbat.
Hey.
All right? Well, it's a good possibility, but we will see it's wrong. It's a nice possibility. It's a very good, solid, logical argument. Not the first time the logical argument was wrong. Okay. The Gemara then goes on. My love, Baka Miflagay. This is just to flesh out what I just said. Is it not that they're arguing about this, the following? One point of view is namely the first Tana in the Baraita has the point of view that there is mourning on the Sabbath. That is to say, you can't have sex on the Sabbath. Umar Savar Ein Avelut B'Shabbat. The other point of view, namely Rabban Gamliel, says you can have sex on the Sabbath, which is to say there is no mourning on the Sabbath. Well, to that the Gemara says, Umimai, what are you talking about? Umimai, what are you talking about? You are assuming too much. Dil ma'ad kan lo kamartana kamahatam ela mishum de meitomu tamafana. Perhaps thus far the Tanakama has not said there, namely in the Baraita, where the Tanakhama is telling us in the Baraita that you can't have sex on the Shabbat, right? That's what he's saying, you can't have it? Well, he's telling you that, Mishum de Neto Mutalafana, because he hasn't yet buried the dead. It's just like the eating, the dead person is lying there, and you're going to be copulating? But I mean, this is ridiculous. You can't do that. The level of emotional upset at a time like that is just too great. So when you learn from this about mourning, remember I said to you before, mourning doesn't begin until after the burial. We're not talking about that here. We're drawing conclusions from a baraita that's talking about aminut, about the period before the burial. And yes, that's a more difficult period. That's a different time. That's a different time. But in this case, namely in the case of a mourner after the burial, the the dead person is no longer stretched out in front of him. He's buried in the ground. Lo. Right? In that case, he would say, in the case of a regular mourner, lo, namely, ein avelut b'shabbat. You could have sex. Right? So we're saying the Tanakhama reasonably is saying you can't have sex before the burial, you could have sex after the burial. That's one possibility. But there's another possibility. The Ad Kan Lo Kamar Rabban Gamliel Hatam. Let's even take the second part. We saw Rabban Gamliel. Right? Rabban Gamliel says you could have sex. Right? So Rabban Gamliel says you can have sex. You want to learn from that. He's saying you can have sex now, before the devil. Ja'akati lo chalade lutale. Rabbi Gamliel has that point of view because not yet, have the laws of mourning begun. The laws of mourning haven't yet begun. But here, in the case where we're talking about the laws of mourning, that says Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. You've been mourning for all those days. The laws of mourning have kicked in. Once the laws of mourning have kicked in, Hachinami, Rabban Gamliel would agree. Rabban Gamliel would agree. Once the laws of mourning kick in, they kick in and they stay. And even he would say that you can't have sex on Shabbat. He just says that you can't have sex on Shabbat before the laws of mourning kick in. The only source we have that says you can't have sex on Shabbat are the laws of mourning. When do the laws of mourning happen? After the burial. Are we talking about after the burial in the Sparaita? No way. We're talking about before the burial. So Rabban Gamliel also. We see the Tanakhama. You can't learn anything about the from the Tanakhama here about a situation of mourning, because he's only applying this maybe to before. He's saying, well, Tanakhama is saying you can't have sex. Well, because it's more difficult. It's more upsetting before the actual burial takes place. After that, maybe you can. And then the second half, we said Rabban Gamliel. Well, you can't say that Rabban Gamliel would say you could have sex. He says you can't have sex only before the laws of mourning have kicked in. Once the laws of mourning have kicked in, he too would agree that you can't have sex on the Shabbat. Okay, how are we doing so far?
I'm confused.
You're confused? I don't understand why. It's so clear. So, which we surely don't know what to do yet.
No.
The Talmud may or may not better tell us what to do. But the Talmud is simply trying to analyze at this stage of the game. We're trying to... And one of the things we're getting fleshed out here, I would imagine that you've thought as we've read this argument, I mean, let's be realistic about this. What are these laws all about? You know, should there really be a difference when you're talking about sex, when you're talking about that kind of a thing? I don't know. I would bet that most people, when they are mourning, don't have any interest in sex. If there's ever a time that you lose interest, I would assume it's then. On the one hand. Okay, that's one side of it. The other side of it is, if we say that you can't have sex, there's another ramification in that. That is, it takes two people to have sex. Right? The husband is the mourner, and the wife wants it. One of the forces of what we are saying here is that even if there is a difference of involvement between the two parties, and one wants and the other one doesn't want, neither can have. So on the one hand, we're talking about the psychologically affected party, whom we can assume is the most profoundly, in most cases, the most profoundly affected of the parties. But we're really setting up a situation which protects that person as well, because the other person can't make demands, even if they're reasonable demands.
Are they equivalent? Are the sexual obligations equal each sex to the other?
No.
Okay, because that, I mean, then what we're talking about here, the issue of the obligation then relative, yeah, so we're talking about a man here, as I understand it.
It's the mourner.
The same law for women.
So this is not sex specific, what we're reading.
No.
It's not male sex.
No. Not necessarily. I mean, you might analyze it and say it comes out of a male perspective, perhaps, but the law is the same for both sexes. So a woman is prohibited to have relations with a man, and a man is prohibited to have relations with a woman. She can't make a demand on him. He can't make a demand on her. Okay? Assuming that either she is the mourner or he is the mourner. So each one is the mourner, be he or she male or female, female or male, those people cannot have relations.
So how do the obligations differ?
The obligations differ because if we're talking about obligations, the man has an obligation to have sex with a woman. A woman does not have an obligation to have sex with a man. Okay? Because a woman has a right to demand sex. A man does not have a right to demand sex.
Right, so then this is sex specific.
No, because no one is saying that obligations are really relevant to this. What we can reasonably think about this is simply that this is called, you know, the intimate relations of a husband and a wife. That one simply asks the other for such a relation. And what we are saying here is that you can't do that because it's a clear prohibition. So it's not necessarily related to an obligation at all. Because in normal relations, people have that general a right, but it's not a religious issue, to ask the other.
For the man, he's obligated to respond if all things being equal, whereas the woman is not obligated to respond.
Correct.
So if the woman is a mourner, obviously that's not an issue for her.
I see what you're saying.
Whereas it is only an issue for the man.
But the truth is it's an issue.
Okay.
I think because of life it's an issue.
Yeah, no,
I think that really what you are dealing with here are the realities of relations between husbands and wives. I think that's really what... When the commentators will occasionally reflect on the mitzvah of onah, the man's obligation to provide the sexual satisfaction of the wife, which they will do. We read that last time. The Tosafot referred to that. I don't think that that's really what's being referred to here. That could be a way of reading it. But I think you're dealing with the normal relations between husbands and wives.
But it's also, at least, I'm not saying this has any relevance, but the other dimension is there's now been a loss of a life in the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems
so
to me,
you should
reproduce it. Sense, you want to deal with that void
as possible.
As quickly as possible.
You assume that they're through childbearing age.
No,
But I'm just saying, I mean, because we've said that.
You might have thought that, but...
You choose an individual issue.
Correct, but there's a balance between the two. Here, obviously, there are individual issues that are taking precedence. And it's a respect for those individual issues that creates, as we've seen it elsewhere, what you're doing here is giving the mourner space. You're really allowing a mourner an enforced space so that a mourner doesn't have to ask for that space. Rather, the community, and the community begins with a spouse, has to respect that space for this period of time. Doesn't go on forever, but it does go on for a limited period of time. And that wall is created around the person.
You know, there's a lot of...
You had a question before, I think.
The idea of the modern view, I think, would be that you're sort of repulsed by anybody wanting to have sex during the mourning period. And we also read earlier that you have... A husband who loses a wife at the gravesite may propose to somebody, to another woman. And it seemed to me that maybe there's just a different mindset 2,000 years ago than we have. That maybe we're sensitive to mourning, and it's very emotional and very overpowering, but perhaps in those days they could more easily, or that psychology permitted them to deal with sex, or sex would be possible in the mourning period.
This would be an interesting subject. I write a PhD on it. If you want to, in your retirement, I have a job for you. Because you will see that the Gemara never comes to a decent conclusion in this subject. This is one of these subjects that goes back, it goes this one, so this, it goes back and forth, and really never comes to any sort of a really good conclusion. That doesn't mean the halacha doesn't come to a conclusion. Halacha does come to a conclusion about this. And in fact, halacha prohibits sexual relations. But what would be interesting to do to follow up on your sociological insight is to follow the whole history. We have it here in the earliest piece, let's say around the second century. see, you know, as this goes on, at what point in history is this matter in effect decided? I don't really know the real answer. I would say probably it's probably around the year 1000 or so, when the law finally is decided. And it's been, therefore, you know, it's not exactly modern. The law's been with us for the last 1000 years. The way we have it today is the way they decided it 1000 years ago. So, but that didn't happen all at once. It didn't happen all at once. And you might be able to show, if you look at the different commentators and the efforts to try and decide this issue, when in time it was decided, and whether there were any circumstances or changes in social behavior that might have accompanied it. Interesting. You want to take it on?
Is it about mundane or about a more energetic?
I don't know.
No, but I mean, when you said it was decided,
It's a morning in general. Because the question is, Yesh Avodah B'Shabbat or Ein Avodah B'Shabbat? And that's the good question here. That's the real question. I think while you were, no, were you outside when we said before the law of Onik Shabbat?
I missed
Onik Shabbat. The Rashi says that one of the issues that is in the equation here is that Rabban Gamliel accepts that there is a mitzvah of Onik Shabbat. If there's a mitzvah of Onik Shabbat means pleasure on the Sabbath. And therefore, the idea that the Sabbath should be pleasurable should allow space for human pleasure as well. Okay? So, but of course, we don't know from this discussion, as we said before, whether this baraita can be applied to mourning, or whether it's only applicable to aninut. We don't know the answer to that yet. But we do know that the general issue of yesh or ein is still unsolved.
Yes. You know, when we studied sexual obligations of a man, depending on the type of work he does, mourning. Nowhere did we study mourning.
Right. Well, truth is,
this is separate and apart, and I think I also felt that there's a psychological dimension here that they were dealing with, depending on how you feel, yes or no.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you that this matter does come up.
Oh, it does come
in
up
in those areas. Yes.
Wait a minute, when we were studying the laws of sex,
you remember so well. That was about 17 years ago. God bless
my
you,
memory
Francis.
Is good. You see that?
Francis, you're terrific. You do a better job than I do. Okay, so let's go back to the text. Oh yes. Okay.
Doesn't anybody say if you're not allowed to eat in the same place and have to go to a neighbor's house or do all of these things, which is also oneg, you know, to enjoy food, and you're not allowed to do that, how could you possibly be allowed to have sexual relations?
If you go to a neighbor's house.
The question is, in the neighbor's house, you're allowed. Let's say you have a room, another room.
Yeah.
Question is, you can eat in that other room, okay? Can you also have sex in that other room? And we're talking specifically now on the Sabbath.
But you're also talking so close to the event. I mean, it's before. I mean, the question seems to be, can you do it before? Because everyone says,
you're sounding like
the
Gemara.
You're talking about right afterwards.
Right after the death.
Right. When the body is covered.
Exactly.
There.
Yeah.
So, you know, it seems as though it doesn't go along with, it seems as though it's much more of a theoretical that they're trying to bring out than the actual. And the only thing that makes sense to me is what you said about actually trying to use this as a principle for not making demands and for separating the morning. Because mm-hmm. in reality, it doesn't make sense that people are really going to be enacting on this, except that rabbi that's, you know, propositioning the woman at the graveside. But
he's not having sex with her. I mean, keep that in mind. But you can think about a lot of things. And keep in mind here, you know, the law seldom regulates what you think about. It will normally regulate what you do. So you could, you know, given all the people that there are in the world and all the personalities that there are, lots of things can happen in the head. But the law structures what you're allowed to do. And in sense, it creates, therefore, this barrier around people.
He was thinking of the children. He wasn't thinking about...
Correct. He was thinking about children. That's true.
If we say...
Not so quick.
If we say that we are patur or free of certain obligations, that does not mean that we are prohibited from doing that.
Patur means it, that's the effect of it, to tell you the truth. It is the effect. And when you're patur, you are, once you're free from the obligation, in effect, in most cases, you're not allowed to do it. Because when we say that you're patur from Kriyat Shema, it means you're not supposed to read the Shema.
Because not say the Shema.
Well, that's going to come up shortly. That is the implication of it. It's actually going to come up shortly. You'll see in another terminology, the terminology of Rishut. There, you'll see the Rambam's are not sure how to understand that. Okay, let's keep going. Where did we go to now? Okay, we go over to 24A1. Now we're going to... We tried to see whether we could learn from this Baraita that there was a similar argument in an earlier period of time about whether there is or isn't observance of private matters on the Sabbath. Unfortunately, the only thing we can say after all is said and done is that we can't learn it from that Baraita. We just can't be sure that the Baraita is talking about our subject. So, we forget a Baraita and we go back to the Amoraim. Ba'amine Rabbi Yochanan Mishmuel. Rabbi Yochanan asks Shmuel, Yesh Aveilut Shabbat, O Ein Aveilut Shabbat. Right? We're continuing with the same question. They don't have the answer to it. Now here, when you're dealing with Rabbi Yochanan and Shmuel, you're dealing with the period immediately after the close of the Mishnah. These are your early Amoraim. Very early Amoraim. Rabbi Yochanan lives in the land of Israel. Shmuel is a Babylonian. And the commentators all note the fact that it's very unlikely that this question was ever really asked, at least as it appears to be, because they lived in two different places. We don't know that they ever met each other. It's not inconceivable that they wrote letters to each other. That's possible. So the assumption is here that when it says it was asked, it's asked in the form of a letter. Amar le Shmuel says to Rabbi Yochanan, Ein aveilut b'Shabbat. Interesting. Shmuel says that there is no private mourning on Shabbat. That is to say, in terms of the issue we're discussing, you could have sex on the Sabbath. If you are mourning on the Sabbath, you could have sex on the Sabbath. Okay. Yatve Rabbanan kamed ala papa. The rabbis were sitting in front of Rav Papa, and saying in Shmuel's name, Rav Papa's yet about two generations later. Okay, and they were saying in Shmuel's name, Avel Shishimesh Mitato B'Yaneyev Lo Chayav Mita. It's a fascinating statement. A mourner who has sex during the time of his mourning deserves the death penalty. Now, this is an odd statement on several levels. First of all, maybe you should say it's not nice. But to say you deserve the death penalty, I mean, that's sort of a really strong statement. Number one. Number two, Shmuel just said, you remember what we just said? Rabbi Yochanan asked Shmuel, is there mourning on the Sabbath or is there no mourning on the Sabbath? Shmuel says there is no mourning on the Sabbath. What was the force of that? You could have sex on the Shabbat. Next statement he comes, and if you have sex on the Shabbat, you die. Now, that's conceivable. I mean, it could be that he's saying, well, it's okay. Yet you're right. There is, technically speaking, it's okay, but if you're so gross to do it, You deserve the worst.
Yeah, but you can just make it differently. You may have law means the other days except the Shabbat.
Maybe that's possible.
Because
possible.
If you say that on Shabbat there is no heaven, then you don't count the Shabbat anymore.
But I can only say that none of the commentators took it that way. They took it the way the English says here. A mourner who has marital relations during his seven days of mourning is liable to death. So there's some problems here. It's not completely impossible to understand, but it's also possible to understand that it is incomplete, or there's something wrong with this. It doesn't seem to follow all the way. So here we have some efforts to work this out. Amalaho Rav Papa. Rav Papa says to them, Asur Itamar. Rav Papa says to them, to the students who are quoting this in Shmuel's name, he says, no. When Shmuel said it, he didn't say that it deserves the death penalty. He said it's prohibited. I said he was concerned. It's just too strong a statement. To say that it's prohibited, I thought we understand. That means the rabbi prohibited it. Fine, we understand that. But to say you get the death penalty, well, that's just too much. Okay? Umishmei the Rabbi Yochanan Itamar. And in addition, Rav Papa says to the students who are discussing this, you said this in the name of Shmuel. This wasn't Shmuel who said it. It was Rabbi Yochanan who said it. Right? And remember, Rabbi Yochanan, we don't know exactly what his point of view was, but he was the one who wrote to Shmuel asking the question. So maybe at an earlier stage of the game, he taught it differently than Shmuel did. Mm-hmm. And only after Shmuel responded to him did he respond in the way. So it doesn't have to be that this is one and the same person and that we have to make both those statements really work with each other. It could be that one is the statement of Shmuel, namely that it's permissible, that is said. Rabbi Yochanan had taught in an earlier time, you have sex, you die. Or, you have sex, having sex is prohibited. That's probably the way he taught it. Okay, that's what Rav Papa said. The ishemir lecho mishmei de Shmuel hachi shemir lecho. And if you did hear something in the name of Shmuel, this is what you would have heard in the name of Shmuel. Amar Rav Chalata bar Avimi Amar Shmuel Avel Shalo Para V'Shalo Feram Chayav Mita. Oh, he says there was a statement that was similar to the one that you taught, but it was actually about a different issue. It was not about sex. It was rather about the following. A mourner who does not Shalo Para, who doesn't let his hair grow long, in other words, cuts his hair, or Shalo Feram, who doesn't rend his garments, that person deserves to die. How can he say that? He says that because it's based on a scriptural source. Shenema Roshechem al Tifrau uvidehem lo tifromo v'lo tamutu. That was the story, remember, of the death of Aaron's sons. And the mourners who remained after that are told, you, because you are in the midst of celebrating the dedication of the Mishkan, you are not allowed to mourn. You are not allowed to mourn. Therefore, Roshechem al Tifrau, do not let your hair grow long. You got to get a haircut. Because you're involved in this big public celebration.
I thought that only applied to the priests, though.
This is what we're talking about. Oh, wait. This only correct. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe we would say in the normal circumstances, no, this priest, I'm not allowed to do this.
Right.
But what would we learn? If the priest, I'm not allowed to do it in this unusual circumstance, then we would learn that in the normal circumstance, a Jew is required to do this. Then he's required to let his hair grow long, and he's required to rend his garment. Right? In this circumstance, though, he's required not to do that. And if he does do it, he deserves the death penalty. So, rightly or wrongly, now Shmuel is elaborating on that to the normal circumstance. The normal circumstance, if you do not observe these two aspects of mourning, which were mentioned in the biblical verse, which were mentioned about Aaron in this sense, and they have the death penalty, you get referral. Okay? Now the truth is, well, let's just finish a little. Ha acher shalo parav v'shalo feram chayav mita. That's the fleshing out of it. A normal person who did not let his hair grow long and who did not cut his garment, chayav mita, that person is obligated to get the death penalty. Now, in all truth, this doesn't make all that much sense. It's hyperbole. It's hyperbole. To analogize from the one situation about the dedication of the Mishkan to the normal state of affairs, which is the normal state of mourning, frankly, there's no analogy between the two, number one. Number two, to presuppose, to presume, that these laws of mourning actually are from the Torah is something that hardly any of the rabbis were willing to accept. Because they saw, by and large, the laws of mourning as coming from a later period of time. Okay? We know that in that unique situation, these unique laws did apply, but generally speaking, in this chapter of the Talmud, when reference is made to those verses in Leviticus, it is not made in order to say that we learn Torah law from it, but rather what we know on the basis of custom we can see has a history to it. See, sometimes we use a verse and the verse is the source of the idea. Other times we have an idea and we find a verse, but the verse is not really the source of the idea. It's called rather an asmachta. And in fact, all the rabbis understood this particular passage as being an asmachta. It's simply used by the rabbis to show historical precedent, but not as the source of the law itself. By and large, the rabbis took all the laws of mourning, though mourning is required from the Torah according to Maimonides, which we read at the very beginning of the year. Mourning is required. The forms of mourning are rabbinic. Just as prayer is required, the Shmona Esrei, the Adeli Amida, is rabbinic. Right? It's the rabbis giving form to something that doesn't yet have form in the commandments of the Torah.
What is the root of Asmachta?
From the Samach Mem Chav, Lismoch. You say in Hebrew, Smoch Alai. Smoch Alai, right? Rely on me.
Okay.
So an asmachta is relying on something. It's an inference. Exactly. It's an inference, but not necessarily a very logical inference. It shows that there is an after the fact. There is something we're pinning it on, a verse, even though we're really not using the verse as the source of it.
Is that specifically because they want to not have the death penalty attached to this?
I think that, in fact, this kind of formulation, chayav mita, is not an unusual hyperbolic formation in rabbinic literature. It's a hyperbole. It's in other circumstances too. And I think that one has to read it as hyperbole. It's one of the ways that the rabbis try to emphasize some things, particularly, and I think that these are things, when I see that, my usual sense is that people were not observing them. Right? Sorry, reasoning backward. Mm-hmm. When they use this strong hyperbole, mm-hmm. probably these were neglected areas. These were neglected areas. I can't really prove it, but that's sort of the feeling that you have when you read things like that. Frequently, sexual things have this type of hyperbole. Because even what I said before, that the law doesn't regulate our thoughts, you have in the Talmud, sometimes it says, if you think about this or that, chayav mita. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean chayav mita because you can't possibly have a bring a case against somebody like that. So obviously, it's meant to be hyperbole. If you read in the art scroll, though, the art scroll will always tell you, well, it means this and it should mean that. And the reason it doesn't mean that, they're not used to reading literature. In literature, this is what happens.
So there's no time frame here. It says, you will not die. That's sort of like, if you obey this, you'll have immortality. It could be one interpretation of it. It doesn't say you'll be put to death.
Deserved
would be a rather more immediate.
Yes, this way you can visit it from the blue.
The way it's usually interpreted by, I think, the less literally sensitive commentators is that they say this is mitab yedei shamayim. Mitab yedei shamayim means a human court cannot inflict the death penalty, only a divine court can. Okay? I don't like that, to tell you the truth, because I'm much more comfortable with this hyperbole. That God should have such an interest in such things, it's uncomfortable.
It's just passing the buck.
You know, I think that this is just the way the rabbis say things, and it's colorful. It's a colorful way of saying
things. The more times they use it, the less meaningful it is.
It's true. The more you would use it, the less meaning it would have.
Yes.
Correct.
I'm kind of surprised, though, that they couldn't, that they chose not to make the separation between oneg meaning a good meal and oneg meaning sexual relations. It seems as though they could say that you can, it seems as though it's this all or nothing kind of definition of mourning and not mourning. So couldn't you have partial mourning, which means that you go to synagogue, you have your nice meal, but you don't have sexual relations, but that doesn't come up at all.
No, that's precisely what they're arguing about. Because remember, that's the view of Yesh Avilut B'Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
Yesh Avilut B'Shabbat is you go to synagogue, you do all those things, but you don't have sex. That's Yesh Avilut B'Shabbat.
And do they call that mourning or not mourning?
That's called mourning on the Sabbath. That is mourning on the Sabbath. It's private mourning on the Sabbath. The other point of view is the opposite. Ein Avilut B'Shabbat, which is to say even those private areas are not controlled by the laws of mourning on the Sabbath. Okay? Well, friends, we have not decided this issue, and we will therefore have to discuss it again next time. This is what the Gemara will do.